Okay, let's begin. Well, I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Ray from the Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. She's done... Her background is in archaeology and Sanskrit and ancient Indian history. And you published quite an array of two single-authored volumes and an edited volume, if I'm correct. The names of which I have here somewhere. It's Archaeology of Seafaring, the Indian Ocean in the Ancient Period. The Winds of Change, Buddhism and the Maritime Links of Ancient South Asia. Monastery and Guild, Commerce under the Satvahanas. So a very solid background in history and archaeology. And today she's going to speak about narratives in stone, the Ramayana in the early Deccan, from the 2nd century BC to the 8th century. And so a very warm welcome to Dr. Ray.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Flan, and I'm very pleased to be here. And this is really work in progress, and I'm moving from archaeology, history, Buddhism, to looking at the temple. I'm going to try out this new work, and looking forward to your comments. Like I said, that, you know, this is something which I have been working on, and it's much more recent rather than something which I published earlier. Let me start by talking about the temple and the various perspectives on the temple that we have, and to place myself within these. One perspective, of course, is that there was a shift from Vedic religion to theistic worship in 9th-10th centuries, and the temple came up as a result of the Bhakti movements and as a result of these different cults that came up. The historical, particularly the historical discussion, as in the writings of Professor R. S. Sharma or Professor Ramila Thapar, which really emerge in the post-independence period in the 50s and later on, links the coming up of the temple to the Brahmins, to the movement of Brahmins from the north. It also links the coming up of the temple to economic developments, the decline of trade, agrarian expansion. So there is that dimension which looks at the economic basis of the temple and the reason for the movements of Brahmins, which then led to the coming up of the religious shrines. The third is can be attributed to Professor B.D. Chattopadhyay, who's written a great deal on early medieval India, where he talks about the emergence of regional states and the fact that these states emerged out of tribal groupings in the 7th, 8th centuries. These states required legitimization, which was achieved by these lineages, which were drawn up by the Brahmins. And in return, donations were made to the Brahmins, and again, the temple gets linked up to changes in political structures and the coming up of or the emergence of the state. Now, I'd like to move away from this, and what I would like to draw on is a really work which places the temple at multiple levels, which places the temple in its philosophical domain as well as in its architectural and sculptural representations. And here I've been very influenced by Kapila Vatsayan's work, where she argues that there is a continuity from the Vedic hymns to the building up of the temple. She looks at Bharata's Natyashastra very closely in this book, and the point she makes is that the Natyashastra is not just a text about performance, but is a text which links several forms of art, such as sculpture, performance, as well as recitation. And the point, of course, that she makes is that we need to look at the plans, and we need to look at the philosophical background of the religious shrines as they emerge. Now, the two, within this sort of broader framework, there are two questions which I am addressing. One is the question which emerges from art history, the writings of which go back to James Ferguson, 1910, which looks at sculptural reliefs and friezes as ornamentation. And the question that I'm then asking is that, are these representations merely ornamentation, or do we need to look beyond beyond the decorative element? The second question that I am also addressing in this presentation is the question of identity. And here again, this is something which has often been said, that religious identity or the Hindu religious identity really came up only in the medieval period with the coming up of the temple. And I'm questioning, or I am trying to propose, that if we look at a cultural identity, can we then see Ramayan imagery, which provided this cultural identity as early as the 2nd century BC, 8th century AD, and can we look at it in a much more pan-Indian space than just some temple sites? Linked to this is the question of the Ramayan narrative, and whether this narrative should be discussed in the context of a single work, such as Valmiki's Ramayana, or whether it is to be seen more broadly in the context of the Ram story. And if we see it more broadly, then of course it has it was taken up, and it's also encoded in Buddhist Jatakas, in the Jain tradition, and of course within this the visual depictions become very important. And what is significant is that these visual depictions are not just on Buddhist sites, but also on both Shaiv and Vaishnava temples. Again, another text or another work which I've been very influenced by is A.K. Ramanujan's work In Many Ramayans, in which he argues that we need to look at the epic tradition much more broadly, and we need to look at the epic tradition in terms of a tradition which has no closure, as it were. He says that there is no core text, or there is no original text from which others are just mere parallels. The visual representations become important for me because for the first time we can then locate these representations in time and space. And here again, I've been influenced by Professor Gavin Flood's work, where he argued, based on Witzel's work, I think, which says that Vedic tradition was really a portable ideational tradition. Where the sacrifice could be performed at any site. Whereas if one looks at the temple tradition, then this becomes located in time and space. It is geographically located, and also it develops in various complex ways over time. But it is much more restricted and cannot be sort of moved from one place to the other. Again, these visual representations, these are the various layers which become important in this, in looking at the representations. I have talked about the philosophical thought that went into it, but what I'm also arguing is that these visual representations are indicators of a vibrant performance tradition, as well as symbols of social and cultural ethos. I have divided this into two or three stages. The first stage I call the stage of experimentation, which is the stage from 2nd century BC to 5th century AD. I call it experimentation because in this phase, most of the depictions are on single panels. We have terracotta plaques, which we do not know where they belong since they occur as individual plaques. We also have representations on Buddhist monuments, a whole range of monuments, Bharat, Sanchi, Mathura, Nagarjuna, Kunda. I'll point these out on a map in a moment. There are also references in Satvahana and Gupta inscriptions to the rulers identifying themselves with the epic heroes, and really using this the epic heroes as righteous kings and trying to emulate them in their work. At this point, towards the end of this point, 4th, 5th centuries AD, there are panels, terracotta panels, from Deogarh and from other temple sites in North India. But again, these panels, I have said, Deogarh has only 10 terracotta panels of the 130 odd that have been identified from the site. But these terracotta panels do not present a sequence. They present just single depictions and single scenes. So the point I'm arguing here is that this is still a phase where experimentation of visual narratives takes place. What is also significant, and this is again something which I'm going to continue talking about, is the fact that many of these representations or depictions carry labels in the Brahmi script. And I will. This is something which I'm going to come back to in a moment. I've used this map just to point out the extensiveness of the Buddhist depictions, starting from Gandhar, Mathura, Bharut, Sanchi, and coming down to Nagarjuna Konda, which is here. So it's really quite an extensive sweep that we are discussing for this 2nd century BC, 5th century AD period. This is from Mathura. On the railing, it is the story of Rishyasringa, which occurs both in the Ramayana and Mahabharata. And the narrative at this time also draws on not just the depiction of Ram and his exploits, but also on several stories which occur in the epics. This is Lakshman. This is from a panel from the Deogarh temple, which shows Lakshman punishing Shurtanakha, and is one of the. I have two depictions here, but there are 10 in all, as I mentioned earlier. And what I would also like to point out is that the site has both Hindu and Jain temples. And again, this is something which I think. Is quite extraordinary that when one looks on the ground, one finds that the same site has several religious structures rather than just having either one or the other. This is transformation of Ahalya, which again is from the Deogarh panel. Let me move on to the second stage, which I sort of date 500 to 750 AD, and in this stage, or at this stage, one finds several depictions, again quite extensive on a larger pan-Indian scale. But what is also quite interesting, and where the change occurs from the previous stage, is the fact that many of these now are in sequence, and you have long sequences as opposed to the single panels or the single stories that we had seen earlier. But what is also quite interesting is that there is no, even at this stage, there is no sort of one area where these panels are to be located, and they occur at various places in these temple complexes. The third point, of course, is that at Badami we have these depictions on the Vishnu temple, whereas at Aihole it is on a Surya temple. So again, there is no uniformity about where they are to be depicted. The area is North Karnataka. It's located here. That, of course, is Goa. So that's just to give you an idea where it is. But what I think is quite extraordinary is about 140 temples were built between between the 6th and the 8th centuries AD in this area. These temples are modest temples. There are not these huge complexes that we know from South India or from other or later on. But also that there these temples have all kinds of plans and superstructures. And so again, it is quite extraordinary the way these are. the two temples, Papanath and Virupaksh, were built at Pattadakal. These, as per the inscriptions, were sponsored by the consorts of the king, especially after his victory over the Pallavas. And so there is a political link, though I'm not very convinced that it was the queens who really initiated temple construction, because in this case, this second mandapa, or the outer mandapa, was added on. The Ramayana depictions are on this wall. And again, what is quite interesting is that these are anti-clockwise. So if one were to go round the temple on circumambulation, one would start with the coronation of Ram, and then sort of move back into the battle with Ravan, exile, abduction of Sita, and then sort of go back till here we reach Dashrath, his performance of the Yajna and the birth of Rama, of Ram, and the training in Vishwamitra's ashram. So the point to be noted here is that these are anti-clockwise, and there has been some discussion on this, which I would come back to in a moment. But the reason why I put this slide in is this is very close to Pattadakal, to the earlier temple that we saw. It's only about 2 kilometers from there. And this is to highlight the fact that we are not looking at the coming up of temples in a void, nor in an area which had no earlier habitation or no earlier forms of worship. These were burials, and these are burials dated to the Iron Age, 1000 or 1200 BC, to the beginning of the Christian era. And this, there are lots of them all around. And just behind them, there's a hill, and on top of the hill is a later Chalukyan temple. But excavations have been carried out just behind the burial all over that area, which show earlier brick temples prior to the coming up or the complex at Pattadakal. The second temple at Pattadakal, which again was sponsored by the consort of Vikramaditya II, is the Virupaksha temple. It is, as you can see, a much different plan. There is the Nandi Mandapa in front here. Here the depiction of the Ramayana scenes are inside and not outside, as we saw in the case of Papanath. The Ramayana panels are on these pillars. There are several pillars in the hall, these huge square pillars. Oops, sorry. And the depictions are on out here on top. The third site that is again contemporary and which also has Ramayana panels is the Durga temple at Aihole. This is to Surya. The depictions are inside on the inner ledge, and I will just go to them in a moment, but they are on the path of circumambulation, which is located there. These are the depictions from the Durga temple, dated the 8th century AD. Another representation occurs at Ellora in the Kailashnath temple, which is very different from what we had seen earlier. And again, on this huge slab, there are several sequences of the Ramayana scene depicted here. In addition to these narrative panels, between 7th and 8th centuries, we also have the early images of Ram showing him with a bow and arrow. This is from two ends. One, the earlier was from South India, and this is from East India, and really shows the Rama image as it emerges in the 7th and 8th centuries AD. Moving on, between the 9th and 12th centuries, there are several regional variations that come up. The temples in Orissa, between 7th and 10th century, we have both kinds of depictions, Ram as Avatar, Ram also as hero of the Ramayana. As compared to the earlier references that we had in the inscriptions, 7th to 10th century inscriptions from Tamil Nadu very clearly refer to Ram's march to Sri Lanka, and in many of the instances, the king prides himself as being of greater valor These are references to the defeat of Sri Lankan kings by the Chola and Pallava rulers. Again, what is quite interesting is that the association with Buddhist sites continues, and at Paharpur, which is in Bangladesh now, is a very important Buddhist shrine, there are Ramayan panels which occur along with several other Hindu deities, as well as at Nalanda. These are representations, or these are depictions from the Pavanath temple, which we had seen earlier. But the reason why I put them back again is because of these inscriptions that we see. And these inscriptions are in Prakrit and are written against each of these panels and each of these niches. They are in Prakrit and identify the characters in the scene that is represented. This is a second scene, and I could continue because all the panels have these inscriptions, and this is something which I do think gives us an idea of what or a clue into why these were presented here, and I will just come to that in a moment. These inscriptions again go back to as early as the 2nd century BC, where we have several inscriptions on Jatakas, identifying the Jatakas. They are also there on the Panchatantra depictions at several of the temples, Alampur and several other sites, and continue until the 15th century. Now, there has been a lot of discussion about what these inscriptions may indicate, or why they were put there in the first place. Some scholars have argued that this was to identify the scene, so people who visited the site and wouldn't know how to sort of relate to what was being depicted, these inscriptions provided them some indication of what the scene was that was depicted. Now, there's been debate on this, and other scholars have argued that this doesn't become feasible because in most cases these scenes are way up and, you wouldn't even see the inscription or the scene. So, the use of these as identification labels may not be very helpful. A second point is that could these be mnemonic devices? And really devices which were used when Ramayan was either performed or recited at the site. And here again, the discussion that has gone on in secondary writings seems to suggest that rather than looking at the Sanskritic or the Indian tradition as a kind of opposition between oral and written, one needs to see particularly the recitation of the Ramayana as an interpenetration of the two, which means that it could be written, then it was recited, then it was taken forward, written again. So it's a whole cycle that continues, and the oral and the written are sort of interwoven in this cycle. And it is here that the temples or the depictions of the Ramayana narratives on the temples become a very important link or a very important sort of part of this chain which moves from the written to the oral and back to the written or so on. Now what, you may well ask, what is my evidence to suggest that recitation or dancing ever happened in the temple? We have several inscriptions, again starting from the 5th century onwards, which refer to dancing and music as part of the temple ritual. These inscriptions come from Gujarat as well as from the Badami, Patadakal, Aihole sites related to the early Chalukyas. The Badami inscriptions also refer to several festivities which were conducted or which took place at the time of the installation of the image, especially at the time of Kartik Purnima. Several privileges were granted to musicians, and these are privileges which were granted at the Virupaksha, in the Virupaksha inscription. So the point that I'm trying to make then is that the temples were not merely pieces of architecture, but were also locales where recitation and festivities took place. And these recitations and festivities sort of linked the temple to the community that lived around, or the community that supported the temple. We are also aware that, and I mentioned this earlier, the Natyashastra, which lays the foundation for relationships between different art forms, particularly dance and sculpture, and the fact that the Natyashastra codifies what was already there on the ground. So the point that I'm trying to make is that we need to look at these representations of the epics, of the Panchatantra, or of various other stories as not merely ornamentation, but also as being part of a continuing cultural tradition which took place within the confines of the temple walls, but also around it, and in a way then link the temple to the wider community networks. There are several dance scenes which occur, which are sculpted on the temple walls themselves. This, of course, is the scene from Deogarh, but there are several other scenes which I can point out and which are known to have existed. What is also important, and this is where the Natyashastra comes in, is the whole connection between dance, sculptural representations, and their association with several deities who are portrayed in dance scenes. Moving on from the 12th century, these temples not only get linked to larger geographic circuits, but there is also a change within the way in which they relate to each other and they relate to the larger sacred geography around them. I have taken at random two instances. One is that of Ramtek Hill near Nagpur. Ramtek Hill goes back to the earliest temple at the site is dated the 5th century AD. These temples at Ramtek Hill were possibly temples dedicated to the Vishnupada. There are also temples of several avatars of Vishnu. We do not have any Ram temple at that point in time. But the hill itself in 5th century inscriptions is referred to as Ramagiri, or the place of Rama's abode, and has been identified with the with references in Meghdoot, which refer to the Yaksha staying at Ramagiri and bathing in the tank in which Sita bathes, so on and so forth. So there is an earlier tradition of the 5th century linking the hill to the Ramayan narrative. But in the 12th, 13th centuries, this hill acquires sanctity which moves beyond its being a local holy place, and it becomes a supra-regional sacred center. Sorry for the spelling mistake. We know this. I mean, how do we know this? We know this from an elaborate inscription dated the 12th century. And the inscription is quite extraordinary in the sense that it provides a mahatmya of the site itself. And so it says that Ramagiri is important because of these tanks around. This is how you should go. You should reach the site. These are the various pilgrimage spots that you should pass on the site. So the inscription which is found at the site, dated 12th, 13th centuries, locates the site in this wider space, or the wider pilgrimage space, and moves the importance of the site beyond its local or regional significance. The other temple that we need to look at, and which again is quite fascinating, is the temple at Melkote. And this is one of the one of the five Vaishnava sites. The Mahatmyas and also many of the stories refer to Melkote as being set up by Ramanuja in the early 12th century. But when one looks at the archaeology of the site, or when one looks at the inscriptions from the site, it is very clear that what Ramanujacharya did was to reinstall the image of God Narayan rather than to install it or establish it in the first place. So in a way, again, there is a sort of revitalization of a temple which had earlier beginnings. And the linking of this Melkote temple with other Vaishnava shrines from the 12th century onwards, several rulers and several other important people at the Vijayanagar court and the Hoysala court contributed or donated very generously for this temple. In the 15th century, a mandapa was constructed, and many Ramayan scenes are sculpted on the panels of this mandapa. So finally then, I have sort of covered a very wide span of both time and space, and the basic arguments that I'm trying to make is that we need to reconfigure the way in which we look at the Ramayana or the Ram story. It was not restricted to any religious affiliation, in spite of the fact that we have 7th, 8th century depictions of Ram as avatar of Vishnu. I would also like to see in my work, and this is something which I'm researching, the temple as an integral part of the community, rather than as an art historic piece or as an architectural or a piece of architectural splendor which was really linked only to the political elite or was sponsored by the ruling communities. If we place the temple within this broader social milieu, then I think there is a strong case for looking at the temple as providing cultural identity to cross-section of society, from political elite to lay devotee. And lastly, I think that recitation and performance are two media which allowed the message of the temple or the message of various narratives on the temple to reach the widest audience, but which also provided a link between these two sort of opposing dimensions that one talks about, the oral tradition and the literary tradition. And I think here again the temple plays a sort of integrating and part, rather than just looking at the two in opposition. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ray. It's really very interesting. It seems to me that actually there's a lot of debate about the nature of Hinduism and how whether Hinduism is a constructed entity or how far back the idea of Hinduism goes. But it seems to me that you've shown with these Ramayana stories that there is a sense of, even though there's no word Hinduism, there is a sense of sort of cultural cohesion and I hesitate to use the word unity, but certainly a shared discourse and a shared stories of, and a recognition of what's going on, particularly when you have these temples that you mentioned. You've got giant Buddhist Hindu temples standing together, and this story seems to cut across these sectarian divides.
Yes.
So there is a kind of so this story does provide some sense of unity or identity at a time when other scholars might well lead us to believe that we have to speak in terms of distinct separate religions or traditions, or even distinct regions cut off from each other.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that has interested me about looking at the temple, is that When one actually visits the site, then one sees, you know, the interplay between different religious groups or religious affiliations, and even at Aihole, the Jain temples and the Buddhist temple are all there with the Hindu temple, and yet, you know, that's not something which we've been taught, or that's not something which one reads about. And so in a way, this got me interested into seeing whether there were other ways. I agree that the term Hindu occurs very late and, you know, may or may not be the appropriate term to use. But certainly the cultural practices and a sort of acceptance of certain cultural norms extends over a much wider area. You know, from whenever the earliest temples appear. And I think really, you know, something which I'm still to come to terms with is, the question about, I'm not very clear about the inscriptions and the representations. I'm not sure how to read them. I mean, that's one way of looking at it now. But I'm not sure that that's the final word. The second is that, and again, something which I would like to look at in greater detail is that once a shrine, you know, once a sacred space is located at a geographic spot, whether it be a river crossing or it be top of a hill, you know, which way does it work? Was it that these spots were there and were, you know, sort of very overpowering, and so the temples came to be located? Or is it that, you know, the temples were located and then all these hills and rivers all, you know, formed part of a wider landscape? So, you know, that's something again which I need to work out.
Well, could that be linked with trade or sort of some kind?
That's you know, that's usually the argument that has been made, that these were all located, Ashokan inscriptions were located on trade routes, and you know, that is where then these become important. But if you actually go and see, say Brahmagiri, you know, where one of, I don't know whether anybody's seen it, but the hill is, you know, the hill is really overpowering. I mean, there's something about that hill. Now, I'm not sure how you sort of work this out academically. You can't, you know, you can't say it was there because the hill was great. I mean, this is a very subjective. But, you know, I'm still trying to figure out whether there's a more academic way of working this out. I'm not so convinced about the trade route argument, though I myself, in many of my earlier writings, have, you know, talked about routes and location of inscriptions, particularly Ashokan inscriptions along routes. But in this, the North Karnataka or the Deccan area, the whole relationship between these burial sites, hills, rivers, is quite complex. And since there's no literary references to go and look at this, I'm not sure how to work this out.
I think there have been cults associated with these sites, even that sort of predate, go on, that keeps on going on all the time. I mean, for example, at Karla, there is even now. There was originally a shrine of the mother goddess there, and it's still being worshipped. And people who came, now that Buddhist caves have lost the significance, people who come to the temple actually regard the Chaitya as the manifestation of the goddess. So this keeps on.
That's true, but that's also what makes it difficult, you know, because you don't know, you can't date any of these. So it is true. So there is this continuity at one level. But how do you handle it?
I would say that there are sort of different, I mean, this is just one example, but...
I agree.
And, you know, for example, there are certain cults which you can't really specify in any of the ritual or textual context.
Yes.
When there's this cult of cleft this whole notion of you pass through a cleft and you emerge purified at the other end. And you see then there is a cleft at Rajgir and there is a cleft at Govardhan, and where these sites come up in completely different trajectories. So
and also these clefts then also become, you know, spaces where damming of water can be done.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you have tanks there.
Yeah.
And the tank, you know, so there's water. And this again is, Badami has it, Chandravalli has it. And so you have the tank, which, you know, the tank can be dated. Okay, you can say that in the 6th century AD, you know, such and such king put up the dam and, you know, got the water collected there. But the water at one level is associated with ritual, but at another level is also associated with agriculture, and is also associated with the settlements around and the use of this for agricultural expansion. So I think the point that I'm trying to make through this is that like you said, we need to look at religion very differently from what we've been doing. And B, I think the temple, as it interacts with the people or with the community, you know, the social milieu of the temple, I think that's something which has not really been talked about. And we've always sort of talked about its philosophical moorings or ritual or, you know, various other ways in which we've looked at the temple.
Just maybe the philosophical aspects of what you're saying, or theological, about the temples having both Jain and
yeah.
Ramayan or Hindu sites. Couldn't it just be that there was a sense of personal identity as a Jain, and I am a Vaishnava or whatever, a Ram Bhakta or whatever, and still they co-interacted? For instance, just my experience being in India, I recently went on a short pilgrimage in Radhakund in Govardhan, which is a Vaishnava site, but the Babaji that was showing me around, as soon as we came into Radhakund, there's the first thing you do is you visit a Shiva temple, and you're supposed to get the blessings of the Dikpala, the protector of the four directions of the Dham, and it's as far as I could tell, they were all Shaivites in there, and they were, so it was a Shaiva temple, but Vaishnavas, before they enter the Dham, you go to that temple. So
yeah, okay.
So my point is that although there was and right next to it there's of course other Vaishnava temples, but a sense of personal identity, despite the fact that these temples are used by both Shaivites and Vaishnavas. That's just a question. And and also, do you think the way that historians have studied Indian religions with the name Hindu and things like that is based on a Western conception of religion, or, and what is that conception? Is it more exclusive?
The Western conception. I think I'm the wrong person to talk about that.
why do you think we've studied in a particular way? I mean, just
Well, that's a big question, and I think there's lots of discussion on that. And I'm sort of just started reading that. But to go to your first question, my position on this is that one could be a Vaishnava or whatever else, and still go to every other temple. You know, being one doesn't preclude you from being the other, and I think that's been a tradition. Even today, you sort of go to a Buddha temple is always there with a Vaishnava temple, but in any case, you go to all of them. Though today, I think things are different because I think Buddhist shrines are being claimed or are being separately identified from Hindu shrines. And this has to do with the whole, politics of the way Buddhism and Ambedkar came up. And, so that's a different issue altogether. But I would certainly agree with you that the identity which I'm trying to present in an earlier period is an identity which is inclusive and not exclusive. So, one could sort of go to many different shrines at the same time. Having said that, I'm not sure how one can establish what an individual's... I'm just looking at it as an academic exercise, how one would establish an individual's identity in terms of religion and how that was perceived. On the ground, as far as I can go, is that, there are all these sites which are together, so there is no disjunction. And many of these, have continued to coexist. But beyond that, you know, that's where I would like to stop. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the way religion has been studied, I think there are, you know, I can only speak for India, and I don't want to get into the Orientalist discourse and all mm-hmm. of that. I think post-independence, we have not had, or in India, there are no departments of religious history or religious studies. And so religion is studied either through the history departments or through Sanskrit departments. I think that's about it.
A little bit of art history, maybe.
Yeah, a bit of art history, mm-hmm. where you study art and architecture.
Philosophy,
yeah, philosophy. Philosophy departments would have, that's true. Now that leaves a large gap. The second point, I think, which comes in and where I think I feel very strongly is archaeology then. You know, I would like to see what I'm doing as the archaeology of religion rather than just studying architecture. And archaeology, in a way, then has got, you know, sort of slotted with history rather than as a separate discipline. So the historians set the agenda and the archaeologists do, you know, whatever is to be done. So I think there are, the way our academic mm. departments have functioned, I think that has a lot to do in India with what we've done and what we haven't done. Mm-hmm.
What about archaeology linked with anthropology?
No, archaeology is linked, the tradition, it's linked with history departments. Mm-hmm. The anthropology tradition comes from the US. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, if at all we have departments, it's ancient Indian history, culture, and archaeology. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the sort of department, the denomination. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, archaeology is sort of at the end of the other two. So that's one. And the second point, of course, is that much of the money for archaeology stays with the government. You know, it's the government who controls the Archaeological Survey of India. So I do think that, you know, there are all these issues which get linked to the way religion has been studied or not been studied.
That sense of a sacred site as a sacred site as a sacred site, whatever label you give it, is there in other traditions, isn't it? That there are, whether it's that it is a mountain that is awesome or a river, particularly a river flowing together that seems significant, that is a sacred site, whether it's a prehistoric place that people go to, or then with a layer of something else, or then with a layer of something else, and that the people that go may not want to use an exclusive label.
Yes.
They may. This is just going to a sacred site.
Except that, you know, each of these sites over time takes on a label. Mm. So the point that Shailendra made, or also say the Buddhist caves in the Western Deccan, you know, in the Ghats, after a point you have, they're all linked with the Ramayana story. So there is Panduleni and there is Sita's Rasoi at Nasik and, you know, something else. But this obviously has happened, you know, some point later in time. It's very hard to decide when this happened. Or at some point they get linked to also the Shilarwadi, the Vithoba cult.
Yeah, and all sorts of different.
Yeah, all sorts of different cults. You know, so, I mean, for a historian, it could be a perfectly valid Buddhist Chaitya site. Mm-hmm. But for the people who live there, it is not. And I think, you know, these are the complexities which emerge only when, I think, people move out and go to the ground and look at the villages and see the sites. Mm-hmm. And will never happen if you just sort of sit and read books in a library. Or even images. You know, a Vishnu icon can be worshipped today as, I don't know, as something completely different. I think it's very complex, and the problems are how to give dates. And unless you do that, you know, it doesn't become good history, it doesn't become good academic work. And I'm not sure how to find a way out of this.
Yeah, just talking about dates, what's the earliest reference in material terms that you find to Ramayana?
If you're looking at the Buddhist depictions, then that's Bharat, 2nd century BC.
But isn't that a bit controversial? Jatak. Is it that boy with a finger in his
that's,
mouth? Is
that's Rishyashringa. No, I wasn't talking about that. No. Yeah. You do have at Bharat, 2nd century BC depictions.
So
the depiction shows the scene is a court, and then, you know, three people leaving the court. I mean, you could argue that these identifications are debated, and you know somebody else might.
But
want
anything
to
more concrete than that, you know, say, I mean, for example, anything beyond say the inscriptional reference in Satakarni's inscription.
But that's 1st century AD.
Yeah, but anything beyond that?
Earlier than that. Inscriptional evidence.
No, any evidence. I mean, inscriptional would be just an example of something material rather than, you know.
No, I think nothing.
Nothing more than that. So that's actually the first concrete material evidence.
Which was that again?
There's a Satavahana inscription in Nasik, which is a kind of a eulogy written for a particular king by his mother.
Yeah.
And that's dated to about 100 AD, kind of 80 to 100 AD period. And that's in that she compares him with Ram and you know all the epic heroes.
And she performs Vedic sacrifices.
Yeah,
she herself performs Vedic sacrifices and says, "My son is so great," and you know he's like the epic heroes.
Yeah.
But I would sort of link it to the fact that it is only from the 2nd–1st centuries BC that we have the earliest demarcation of sacred space, as it were. You know, it's only with the Ashok and his inscriptions when he goes and he says, you know, okay, I'm establishing this stoop of such and such Buddha, that you, for the first time, I mean, wherever you date Buddhism, beginnings of Buddhism, or wherever you date whatever else, that's the earliest evidence
the first time,
that we have for, you know, territorial demarcation of sacred space.
Linked with a king, a polity kind of
person? No, any kind of religious shrine. Now, the question here, and again, this is something which I'm not sure, if you, you know, are we, at one level, the Chaitya is also a burial space. But if one looks at burial spaces, then the megaliths go much beyond. You know, they go to 1000 BC. But there, we are not sure whether this burial space was also a revered space. I mean, it was important. But whether this distinction between sacredness and death, I'm not sure how to handle that. And whether, you know, can one talk about burial space as a sort of sacred space?
I think, I would, but...
Okay.
So
then
in terms
in
of
which,
ancestor worship, yes. I mean, if you take that thing.
Yes, but, you know, the point again remains, is it ancestor worship? Because all that they're doing is that they have this one spot where everybody goes, not everybody, but the important people or whatever, they go back and they take the bones of their ancestors and put it there. So there is a definite area earmarked for
that.
That
area again, so... Kind of
chicken
kind of question.
Yeah, and then whether they worshipped it or whether this was just linked to, you know, where their original village was, or these are not issues that we have evidence for.
How far could a student of narratives, narrative of the Ramayana, benefit from studying the sculptures? I mean, perhaps not very much.
You know, one of the suggestions that has been made, and I think Professor Brockington made this, that if one looks at the depictions, what they are, and you know what is written in the text in, say, the Valmiki Ramayana, then one gets, you know, one can make a kind of what should one say, a comparative study of the narrative and the text.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which event got introduced or not introduced. Now, the flip side of that would be that there are sculptures which are lost or not identified or, you know, not available. So this would just be one way of doing this exercise.
Yes, I mean, I was thinking of attempts to link the Homeric narrative with the Greek pots. I mean, you can do a certain amount there, and this will give some account of the dating of relevant motifs or themes in the narrative. But I don't know. I mean, Brockington is suggesting that you could do something similar. Has anyone done anything of this sort that you know of?
A kind of comparative study of the two?
I wasn't thinking of comparing the Greek, but
no,
just
no, no. I mean, the sculptural representations and the written text.
Yes.
I'm not sure that that has been. I mean, there is. There are studies which have been done which talk about Ram emerging as an avatar of Vishnu and looking at the narratives or the sculptural representations and the texts. Mm-hmm. I think Alpana Desai did it, and there are others who've done that. Mm-hmm. But specifically with the Ramayana text, I'm not sure.
I believe the most important thing that you can do with this is they actually provide you some sort of chronological marker that, you know, this particular bit was known in this particular time, if you can ascertain the time that is. But I think that's the most important sort of study-wise, from narratives to sculpture. That's the kind of link that one can form. I mean, talking about that, you know, that's the strange things of the terracotta plaques where... Again, it's, you know, whether it's Ram or whether it's... I mean, there are these terracotta plaques showing a woman being taken across kind of, you know, the sky route, and she's dropping little ornaments.
Yeah.
Now, this matches so much with the story.
Yeah.
So people immediately jump to the conclusion that, yes, this is it.
Yeah.
But, well, the first question is it?
Yeah.
Is that it? And if it is, then obviously you can say that, well, at least this part of the story was known in 1st century BC or whatever that is.
So it's likely to be, though, isn't it? I mean, it's...
Well, what wonders me, I mean, like, there's a huge range of these images available. Mm-hmm. And why this particular bit of the story and not the other characters?
So, so essentially, you've got all these Jatakas represented. We've got the text, we've got the representation of the stories there.
And that case is quite clear, because they are all identified with labels. Like, this is this Jataka, that Jataka.
Oh, does it actually say that? Oh,
Yeah. Some in Bharat Sardinis, it says the Jatakas, and the labels
are
there.
I see.
So it's easier. But I think... you know, if one sees overall the representations, I think there are two, I don't know whether it's just because they are so dramatic, but there are two scenes which keep recurring again and again. And this is, one is the abduction, and the other is the Vali Sugriv, the fight, you know. So, and the abduction, I think, just, you find it everywhere. I mean, you may not find other things, but that is there all the time. But I think methodologically, you know, the point is that these terracotta plaques occur between 2nd century BC and, say, 1st century AD, all over the Ganga Valley at several sites. And they have all these depictions. Some show a goddess standing on in a temple and, you know, sort of structure. And people have, and some scholars have said that, you know, you can identify the story by looking at the text and saying this description occurs there, and so this is the story. But I think methodologically, that creates problems, because methodologically then one could read any text, you know, not any text, but say, okay, this the text is later, and so I think there are problems to these identifications.
But coin-wise, I can tell you that there is...
when is the earliest...
Well, I mean, we have... representations of someone that looks like Ram on Hovishka's coins. So, I mean, with a bow and arrow, with a very clear bow. And
what dates are they?
It's pretty strange, because these, they can be either Hovishka's dates, which is like 150, 60 AD, but these particular coins are sort of towards the end of his reign and could be imitations, but they're certainly not later than 300 AD, I would say. But the fun part is that, again, that this particular icon, usually Kushan coins have icons which are labeled. This particular one is not labeled, but the iconography is the same. There's a man standing in a Tribhanga posture with an arrow and a bow in his hand, so it looks pretty much the same to the other things. But you do have, I mean, I can, if you want an image, I can.
Oh,
for,
thanks.
For,
okay.
For this one, I can give you the first actual clear representation is on the Chahamana coin that comes in what 11th century, and there's the figure of a Ram written Sri Ram written there. So that's.
But there is a terracotta. There is a terracotta image from one of the sites in Haryana, which has you know, a standing figure holding the bow and arrow, and it has Ram written there in Brahmi. And this is, I think, 2nd, 3rd century AD. And it also has a verse of the Ramayana, Valmiki Ramayana. So there it's easy. You know, if they give verses, then it's easy. And if they write, then it's easy. But otherwise...
Like you suggested, this bar of three people leaving, there can be any three
people leaving. There can be any three people leaving.
But if the three people leaving are stylized in a certain way, we know from later sculptures.
Yeah, they do. I mean, that's fine. Yeah,
that's true. But there's so much iconographic variation in this period. Yeah, you know, 200 BC to 400 AD.
Yeah.
That you know, the icons are not clearly confirmed or stated. So.
And especially in this period, like especially the so-called Shunga period, they keep on changing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You have, and coming back to the religion thing, that it's. People, I mean, we had a talk given on essentially on coins, and the guy came up and said that, but you know, this can't be Gajalakshmi, because what is a Gajalakshmi doing on the gates of a Buddhist shrine? But I think that question is not really pertinent.
It doesn't arise at all.
You know, it's just a cult, and a body of clergy is trying to compete for the cult so that they can get more money out of
it. Sure.
And that's the essential dynamic, how all these churnings go on. Is
mm-hmm.
you know, that mix admixtures
mm-hmm.
keep on going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do our best then, I think, with dating this material and so on, and seeing you know, trying to link these things with specific stories and so on. I think you've done a very interesting work here. It's a thanks so much for telling
us
about
it. Oh, thank you for the comments and for the interest.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And